Welcome to Put Simply, the podcast that puts what's happening around the world simply without compromising on the details. Erdem Koch is my name, and well, with just a few days to go till polling day in the United States that will determine the next president of that country, we thought we'd do things a little bit differently this week and speak to a pollster based in the United States. Alex Tarascio is the Director of Policy and Political Strategy at the US polling firm Signal, based in Washington, D.C. Now, a little bit about Signal. Signal started in 2007 as a regional general consulting firm, and then it really started to ramp up. Now, of course, polling firms and pollsters have been criticized in the US, given the fact that, you know, a lot of them missed the results between Clinton and Trump in 2016. Similar ones were accused of missing the results in the 2018 midterms, again in 2020, in the Trump v. Biden race. But the reality is polling remains a big part of our life. Signal is a polling firm that was named by the New York Times as the number one most accurate polling firm in 2018. In the same year, 538 said Signal was the top Republican polling firm, which was reconfirmed in 2020, with Signal calling the most races correct of any Republican shop in the nation. So what a better firm to have some insights about the race on. So it's wonderful to welcome Alex to Put Simply. Alex, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for your time in what must be a busy week. Can I start by asking you to introduce yourself and explain what it is that you do?
Happy to, and I'm happy to join the podcast today. My name's Alex. I work at Signal. We are a polling and analytics firm. I work for political campaigns all around the world, corporate clients, public affairs clients, and nonprofits. I help clients that I work for to figure out what messages resonate the most, who those messages resonate with, where those people are, and how to reach them. If you're hiring me, then you want to target voters for a specific campaign and you want to win that campaign. If you're a corporation launching a product to go to market, you're probably not working with us, although I'd love to talk to you. I'm never going to turn anybody away. People that are working with me have a problem that they need to solve. It's winning some campaign. It's defining what message and what direction that they want to take. Clients that I work with generally know where they want to end up. I help them use data to chart a course for how they get there.
So Alex, for those of us who don't live in Washington, D.C., what's the feeling like? I mean, I get the sense that it's almost like this huge buildup and anticipation to one of the most prominent days on the calendar every 4 years. What's the streets like? What are people feeling? What can you feel when you sort of park your car and walk around, or when you go to the office? Give us a little bit of a taste for that.
Well, I love it, but I'm kind of a strange, unusual person. I'm representative of almost nothing. There's a lot of political animals in DC, but there's tension in the air too. And, that may be because in 2016, after Donald Trump was elected, which was really a shock to the system, I remember the next day people came to work openly crying and taking Xanax and discussing that very freely. And it was a strange time. And that defined the era that we're still kind of living in now. There's exhaustion with the whole era. I think that when Kamala Harris says something like turn the page, there is a subset of people, particularly in DC, that know what that means. But there's also just exhaustion and people are tired of it. And so there's weariness in the air. There's tension in the air. I think people are kind of holding their breath to see how things shake out. I've had discussions about whether or not you should go into Washington on election day, which I think is fine. I don't think there's going to be any problems. But depending on how the race turns out, businesses will very likely be deciding whether they want to board up their windows, as they've done several times over the past several years. So there's tension in the air, but there's also excitement in the air. And, DC's 95-96% Democratic. And so they'll be happy with a Kamala Harris victory and certainly very morose if Donald Trump wins.
Alex, I'm going to start from the last question that I think, any interview would usually ask, and I'm going to ask it first, and then we can break things down from a data perspective. Based on all the information you have and all the polling and the data that you and your colleagues have gathered for quite some time now, who will win the US presidential election and why?
Great question. I've been having this conversation a lot with people, as you might imagine. I think that the race is extremely close. That's not profound. You can see that in any polling, any aggregator that's out there. There's very few that show the race outside of the margin of error because it's extremely close. It's a lot closer than it was in 2020. It's a lot closer than it was in 2016. Those were years where there were polling misses. Although one of the reasons that I work at Signal is because Signal got it right in 2020. They got it right in 2018. We're highly accurate in our polling for a lot of reasons. But inside our data, public, private, and when I'm looking at public data from other pollsters, that doesn't change the reality that it's an extremely close race. That said, in the past month, particularly since October 2nd, 3rd, 4th, there's been a narrowing of the race from where it stood in the summertime toward Donald Trump. It's not a lot, but it's persistent. It's been gradual. And at this point in the race, I think that he is a slight favorite to win. Part of the reason for that is because his campaign's been highly accessible. They're going everywhere. They're talking to everybody. They're going into Black communities. They're going to the Muslim community. They are talking to young men on podcasts who don't listen to mainstream media. They are talking to anybody who wants to talk to them. I think that makes an impact. I think when you ask people for their vote, then they consider that genuinely. And he'll see gains no matter what happens in all those communities that I mentioned. There's a bigger gender gap than ever. That's pretty well known and well talked about. But inside the Muslim community, which is pivotal in Michigan, inside the Latino community, which is spread across the entire United States, but particularly important in Nevada and Arizona, he's going to see gains in all these groups. And so, you know, we can go into some of the details, like state by state and group by group, a little bit later, but it's just a way to say that he's gaining with the people that he needs to gain with. The places where he's strongest are in the states that are best for him. The places where Harris has her best states, the polling is a lot closer. And so for that reason and for several others, I give Donald Trump the slight edge. And one more point I'll make on this before we move on. It's less that Donald Trump is gaining support. He consolidated a little bit earlier in early October, late September, and more that Kamala Harris is losing support. We saw her peak in that same time frame, and now in our trend lines and our data, we're seeing it drop a little bit. And so she's going from 50 to 49, 48, 47, 46, you know, nationally and depending on the state. There are some reasons for that. I think the main one is that she is not a very good candidate. When she gets out and speaks and gives interviews, which she has started to do within the past month, she hadn't really done it in the summer, she has embraced a strategy of not answering questions in the way that most people expect questions to be answered. She pivots, no matter what the question is, to attacking Donald Trump. She's taken message discipline to a level that I've never seen before, and which is not a good thing. I've seen that in focus. That's not just my opinion. We've seen in focus groups that voters, undecided voters, really just want to know what Kamala Harris wants to do. They don't want to know what she thinks of Donald Trump. They know what she thinks of him, but they want to know what she's going to do on immigration. They want to know how she would deal with policy differences with the Biden administration. And she has been very persistent and extremely disciplined in not giving voters that information. I think that's turned people off, not in a massive way, but in a small way that has contributed to the small erosion of her support in the polls.
And obviously the focus of both candidates are on those swing states, those critical states that are the toss-up states in the US. Take us through them, Alex. They are obviously the ones that will decide the outcome of the presidential race. What are we seeing in them, state by state, and why?
So that the last part of that question is the trickiest. What do you look for on election night? Unlike most countries in the world, the US rarely has a result on election night. That's unfortunate. I wish we did. But let's go through some of them. The big ones are the blue wall states. That's Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. Those are the ones that you should watch closest. Michigan, don't quote me on this, I'm 90% sure, does not start counting their ballots until polls close at 7:30. That's certainly true. And they stop at 11:30. And so there's a very narrow range, 4 hours or so, where they're going to count ballots on election night. They're not going to finish. If they do finish, or if they finish and they're close enough that they call the race that night, it will mean that it's not a close race. That's possible. That happened in 2016. That happened in 2012. There could be a polling miss. I don't see anything in the data to support that that's going to happen. There's lots of theories out there for why there might be a polling miss, but the reasons that there were in 2016 and 2020 are different than the reality on the ground now. So I would not anticipate that. And I would also not anticipate a result in Michigan on election day. Wisconsin, a little bit more likely that they will count enough of the ballots that we might know, but it is an extremely close state. It's the closest of the three in 2020. It was decided by, I think, 0.6%. And it's a state that has been a little bit more favorable to Trump. We have a public poll in Michigan and in Wisconsin that are coming out on Saturday. And so I'd be happy to share those with you. You can share them with your audience and you can see what our official prediction is of what the result is going to be in those two. We have private polling in Pennsylvania that I can't share, unfortunately. And so I would point you to the abundance of data that exists from other pollsters. But Pennsylvania is a little different than the other two in that it has a bigger gender gap than any of them. There are more women that will vote in Pennsylvania than men. We have it at about 6%. That's our expectation. Other pollsters see it a little differently. And so women are voting more Democrat this year than men. Men are voting much more Republican this year compared to women. It's still a close race. That close race does not mean that there hasn't been movement among the constituent voter groups in each state. And so we're seeing divergences there with men and women. We're seeing divergences on race. And that's a little bit evened out across the board with Democrats picking up more college-educated white voters, which has historically been a constituency that favored the Republican Party. So the end result, even though there's so much shifting underneath, is a race that's still close, that still appears static, but there's a lot of activity under the surface. So that's the first three. Pennsylvania is extremely unlikely to be called on election night. They don't start counting mail-in ballots until polls close as well. I think that's unfortunate. I wish they counted them earlier, but they don't. Last cycle, we knew, I think, 4 or 5 days after Election Day what the result was in Pennsylvania. And I don't see any indication that it's going to be less close now than it was back then. Part of the reason for that is that the two campaigns will spend probably close to $500 million in ads targeting that state. And so there's some trends that we see nationally, a narrowing toward Donald Trump that we haven't necessarily seen in Pennsylvania. Still very tight, still very close, but there's a week left and we'll see. I'm not confident to give you a prediction about who's going to win because it is so close in Pennsylvania. In the other two states, the one that I think is most likely to go to Trump is probably Michigan. And I may change my view on that once our public poll is out because I'm relying on other pollsters for Michigan and Wisconsin data. And so I wouldn't bet the mortgage on that particular bet, but I'd probably bet you a small sum of money that Michigan will go his way. I think that Arab voters are particularly upset. I think Muslim voters we're looking for something a little bit different from the Biden administration than they got. And I think there's a really palpable sense of betrayal in that community on the Israel-Gaza issue, and a sense that the administration of which Harris was a part has played both sides. You would think that that community would not favor Donald Trump as a result, because he's been pretty clear that he wants Israel to prevail over Hamas, but that's the reality is more complicated. When he's talked about being a president of peace and not wanting to have more wars, and that he can point to his record as not starting any new wars, that's a message that resonates pretty strongly inside that community, even though the reality of his Gaza policy would probably not be something that they would like. So moving on from the blue wall states, let's go out west. That's where I'm from. So Nevada has been a tricky state for Republicans for many, many years. It has not gone Republican in, more than two decades, I believe. But this year, it is one of the most likely states to go Republican. There's been some encouraging data to come out in the early vote that suggests that Republicans are turning out more. And they have made gains with the Latino community as well, very strongly. There's a lot of blue collar workers, people who don't make a ton of money, but they have good jobs. They have decent paying jobs. These people have been hit really hard by inflation, really hard by cost of living. And they generally have more traditional values in Nevada compared to, say, where I'm from, where it's much more highly paid, much more highly educated, and consequently more Democratic. And so in Nevada, I do expect that Republicans are going to win, maybe even on election night, but it's historically been a pretty difficult state to poll as well. There's a lot of reasons for that. And I would not be shocked if that one turned out to buck whatever the trend and predictions are inside the public opinion data, at least the stuff that's publicly available. That's why people are so interested in looking at the early vote data for Nevada. That's worth 6 electoral votes. And so my map has Trump winning the Sun Belt states, including Nevada, but he still needs to pick off one of the blue wall states in order for him to walk away a victor. But I think he'll take Nevada. Going to Arizona, that one has always been more comfortably in Trump's camp. We're going to have a poll come out, I think, tomorrow for Arizona. And I want to see that data before I make a really firm projection. But looking at the publicly available data, it looks pretty good for Trump right now. That would be a departure from the trend of the last few cycles when Trump was on the ballot included, where he was rejected by large swaths of Mormon voters, of suburban voters, of people who really, really detest Trump's style. But this cycle, it seems to be a little bit different. And in fact, I was texted an image last night from somebody who saw signs going up in Phoenix yesterday that say Trump Gallego. And Ruben Gallego is the Democratic candidate for Senate. He's running against Kari Lake. Kari Lake is running several points behind Trump. And so it was interesting to see that somebody is promoting split ticket messaging. It's not the Gallego campaign. And so presumably it's the Trump campaign that wants to pick off voters who are willing to vote for a Democratic senator, but are also considering voting for a Republican presidential candidate. That's a little strange. And I haven't lived in Arizona in a while. And so I want to resist the impulse to make a firm prediction until we have our own data there. Okay, so that's 5. Georgia, we have a poll coming out this week that will tell me a little bit more about Georgia. It's looked better on the public polling that's available. That's all I'm confident to say right now because I don't have my own data that I can point to. But it's a very narrowly divided state. It's a state where Kamala Harris has spent quite a bit of time. It's kind of the inverse of Nevada in many ways, that the Democrats picked it off in 2020. They think that they can pick it off now. There's a very active Black community in Atlanta and throughout the state. But inside that community, in among young men, Trump has also been targeting those folks and trying to make gains there. And so it's a state that both campaigns have put a lot of energy and effort into. And then in North Carolina, where I do have data, it's internal. There's some trends that have been a little surprising in some of the early vote data, but I think it's a mistake to dig too much into that. The top lines have it being fairly favorable to Trump. There are some polls that have North Carolina coming in as a narrow Harris victory. I don't think it's going to be declared immediately. It's not going to be among the first states that gets called, but it's a close one. It's one the Trump campaign feels pretty confident that it can win. And a lot of what the early vote data suggests is that people who are voting are more highly educated, they are higher income, they live on the coasts more. A comparatively bigger percentage of Republican defectors voting for Democrats are in that same group. And so the early vote data and some of the data that I've seen is more favorable to Democrats, which is interesting and a little surprising, given that the overall samples are more Republican. One caveat that I want to say about North Carolina before I go any deeper is that Hurricane Helene has thrown a bit of a wrench into the data. And I want to take it with a grain of salt. People are not going to be as interested in answering their phones if they've lost their house. That doesn't apply to a huge number of people. We can still poll the state. We've been pulling it every other day in a tracking poll. And I'm confident in our data, but when there's a really large scale disaster that changes people's priorities, then you got to accept that into your frame of what those numbers mean and what people are prioritizing and voting for. So that's my ring around the swing states.
Can I ask you to clarify a term for us in the spirit of this podcast, putting things simply? When we talk about the margin of error, what are we talking about? I mean, and what does that margin of error mean? I mean, is it different in different countries? Is it different in the US? And the second part of the question is what is a comfortable margin for a candidate to be leading for then you and your firm to make a prediction that the state will turn red or turn blue?
So margin of error there's no difference statistically in what margin of error will mean in the United States versus any other country. At the beginning, I said that I'm a pollster. I'm actually an international pollster. Most of the work that I'm focusing on is around the world. And margin of error is determined by your sample size as a proportion of the overall population. And so the greater sample size you have, the lower your margin of error is. If I want to poll 100 people, I'm going to have a very high margin of error. If I want to poll 400 people, then you can get pretty low margin of error. If you want to poll 1,500, which is what we're going to be doing, what we already did in the national poll that we'll release today, the margin of error for that one is like plus or minus, I want to say 2.5 or 2.7%. And that's just a mathematical equation. And so there's not a difference in where you do it. It's a matter of how many people you're serving as a proportion of the population. But you can only get it so low. And margin of error can't really fall to a point where you can make it entirely predictive. And so there's not a ton of utility in going from a poll that has 1,500 people to going to a poll that has 5,000 people. The relative increase in cost that you're going to bear in putting that poll together versus the greater accuracy is limited. And you had a second half to that question as well. How far outside the error margin do they need to be? As a rule of thumb, usually 3%. And so when folks are saying that the race is inside the margin of error, they mean that it's within 3%. And so if you have Kamala Harris at 51 and Donald Trump at 49, then that might end up being Harris anywhere from 54 on the high end to 48 on the low end. And Trump anywhere from 46 to 52. And so anything in that range, the poll is still considered accurate, which is frustrating when you have extremely tight, close races.
Well, one of the standout stories of any US election is voter turnout and the number of people that actually come out to vote on the day. And of course, a lot of people have already voted. So tell us about this segment of the population. Who are the people that have already voted, and what impact, if any, are they likely to have on the outcome?
The people who have voted more, I'm glad you asked this question. I took some notes on it earlier, and so you'll forgive me for looking at some of these. I was curious about trends with already voted individuals because I suspected that it was going to be higher income, higher propensity voters. I voted early. I voted like 3 weeks ago or something. And the data basically confirms that. And so voters who earn above $125,000 a year, for instance, they are the most likely to have already voted early or by mail. They are the most interested in the election. It's the group most likely to say the U.S. is on the right track. It's a little bit more Democrat leaning compared to other groups. But there's some other trends in like favor local control for Republicans versus control of Congress. The same voter group prefers Republicans to be in charge locally versus nationally. I think there's quite a few reasons for that that I can theorize about, but maybe a little bit later in this because I don't want to get too far off. This is a group that is doing well, generally. They are a little bit happier with the status quo. And so to the extent that Kamala Harris represents the status quo, she's part of the current administration, it's not a surprise to me that this group nationally is a little bit more favorable to her. There's some number of Republicans who will not vote for Donald Trump, a little bit more of them than Democrats who will defect and vote for Trump and not vote for Harris. It depends on the poll, but it's a couple percentage points more. Those Republicans, you might call them Nikki Haley voters. You might call them never Trumpers. They feel very, very intensely about Donald Trump. Donald Trump is their main issue. And so those voters are generally a little wealthier. They're generally a little higher educated, and they are early voting, and they're voting for Kamala Harris more frequently. It's not by a ton, but you're talking about a couple of points of an edge in the states that I've been looking at.
Allow me to ask you to now complete the next sentence, and we'll do it for both camps, right? So starting with the Democrats, Kamala Harris will win the US presidential election because...
because the country did not want to return to a Donald Trump presidency. It wanted to, I'll use her language, it wanted to turn the page on the chaos. It wanted to turn the page on the negativity. I think I'll leave it at that. I don't want to write her press release for her. But that will be, if she wins, that will absolutely be the reason why. And there's a a ton of data to back that up. And she would agree with that assessment on my part. I don't think that there would be any disagreement if you had a Democratic pollster next to me.
Donald Trump will win the U.S. election and return to the White House because...
because voters wanted a return to the economic and global stability of the first Trump administration.
And finally, Alex, what's one thing or a few things that surprised you in this election? I mean, is there something that the data is telling you or focus groups are telling you that perhaps it's a story that hasn't been told? What sort of insights can you offer?
Gosh, there's a ton. I think the thing that surprised me the most consistently throughout the election is the strategy that the Harris campaign has employed. Because Donald Trump is a deeply flawed candidate. I still think that he's going to win, but the fact that he's not leading comfortably is an indication of what his weaknesses are. The people that dislike him very, very strongly dislike him. I don't think that that's a winning strategy. I would not have advised the Harris campaign to do that. I would have encouraged her to have a positive message, something that's a little bit closer to, you know, what Barack Obama accomplished, what Bill Clinton accomplished at various points in getting voters to believe in, you know, hope for a tomorrow and a better future going ahead. That's generally what wins elections here. And she's done the opposite. She's really looked to the past and she's really focused on her opponent to a degree that's really unprecedented. That has surprised me. The other route was possible for her. She could have done that. And the fact that she doesn't or hasn't, if she loses, that will be the reason why. And it shocks me that she has employed a strategy of answering every question by going back to Donald Trump. Voters want more. They're expecting more. They hope for more. And something in the data to support that, and I was looking at it today, is in our last two national polls, including the ones coming out today, we always ask the question of which political party do you think is more extreme? And in the summertime, people thought that the Republican Party was more extreme by like 4 or 5 points, something like that. In the last two polls that we've done, it's flipped. And now people are saying that the Democratic Party is more extreme. And that's a curious result. It's notable. It's persistent. And that's what happens when a candidate or campaigns, you know this as you've worked on them before, when you go negative. It's one of the big reasons why in the U.S. you want your outside groups, you want your super PACs to do all the negative ads against your opponent so that the campaign can talk about a positive vision for the future. The reason that you do that is that when you talk about Donald Trump being a Nazi, Donald Trump being a fascist, the Republicans are going to put people in trains and put everybody in concentration camps. That freaks people out, and it turns back on the messenger. And it's a double-edged sword in you know, every sense of that term. And so there's consequences to that strategy that she's employed. And I can see that in the data when people look at that party as more extreme. It's part of why I think that it's narrowed the ballot between her and Trump. Because she has just failed to deliver that positive message. It was doable. This was not the only strategy that she could have picked. And this isn't just my opinion as a Republican who wants her to lose. This is opinion of Democratic professionals who I respect and spend a lot of time reading and listening to. And so voters have been waiting for that positive message to come out of her. And they've been disappointed in that she's chosen at every point to stick with this negative message. And that's really the main reason why I don't think that she wins at the end of the day. It's less about Trump, and it's more about she was not able to come through on a campaign that was winnable. Donald Trump doesn't surprise me anymore. Nothing Donald Trump does can surprise me. We've seen him forever. He's the same man that he's always been. And if you want something new out of Donald Trump, you're probably going to be disappointed.
Well, Alex, I know it's a super busy week for you and your firm, and you are inundated with requests, so I deeply appreciate you taking the time and taking us through the data in such an articulate way. Good luck for the remainder of the days, and I hope to connect with you again soon.
Thanks a lot, Artem. I appreciate it.
Alex Tarascio, the Director of Policy and Political Strategy at the polling firm Signal, joining us from Washington, D.C. Let me bring in my co-hosts now, Ozan Ibrahim and Rodney McCune. Gents, thank you for your patience and for waiting. I think it was definitely well worth hearing from Alex. Rodney, let me start with you. What do you make of where things are at with a few days out of polling day? We've obviously gone through the data, so we won't go through the sort of the states again. But I want you to make a prediction. Who will win the election and why will that candidate win the election based on what we've seen?
All the data is obviously pointing to it being incredibly close. But the momentum in the last week or two has been tipping towards Donald Trump. And notwithstanding the Puerto Rico stuff and the little bit of firestorm, I think it was described as, in a number of media outlets around that, the nothing's changed substantially. And I'm going to say why. This type of thing will have an impact, but the level of impact will be mitigated by the fact that so many more Republicans are voting early at this election. Previous elections, mail-in ballots, voting early was not a Republican thing, but it certainly is at this election. So some of the people that Trump may have offended by the joke by this comedian, and it wasn't just that joke, there was a series of pretty off comments from a whole host of lunatics at the Madison Square rally that he held, Tucker Carlson, I mean, really very odd individual, makes Elon Musk look normal. Rudy Giuliani is a walking freak show as well, if I'm being honest. But anyway, had this whole host of crazies, as I'm going to describe them, come out and do their bit, lots of offensive stuff and whatever. But a lot of people who may have been offended have already voted. And I think it was CNN did a piece with a number of Puerto Ricans, some of whom had already voted for Trump. There was certainly Puerto Ricans in the audience at that rally. There were Puerto Rican speakers who were still endorsing him. And when you are able to offend a huge community like that and get away with it, you get away with it because that community is visibly still divided. And that's what they managed to achieve. Obviously, what Biden said afterwards played into their favor again, despite the fact that Trump has been calling people scum and so on. And that's not seems to have caused any great problems. So I think that that Puerto Rico issue is not going to be the seismic event that maybe Democrats are hoping for, or to be honest, emotionally seizing on to get themselves through the last few days of the campaign. And therefore, I don't think a great deal has changed. Many of the people, I mean, look, I thought Kamala Harris gave a very good closing speech, but there was still a heavy component of Trump bashing. And Trump bashing, unlike Kamala bashing, is not something that resonates or speaks to her core vote in the same way that Kamala bashing speaks to Trump's base or core vote. So it doesn't always help her. I also think there's still that gap of, yes, we know what he would do. We know why you don't like what he would do. I may agree with you and say, I don't like what he would do, but what would you do? And even on the economy, I know that it's maybe closer in some of the swing states where there's been more targeted media, but he's still up on the economy, and that may well be the defining issue. There was a Puerto Rican voter, again, anecdotal, but gave the reason why he was still voting for Trump, because he's going to be better for the economy. And all these other issues around abortion, other, I'm going to say other issues, but we know what they are and we've rehearsed them and so on. If it does come down to the economy, he's going to come out and win this election. The economy and immigration have cut through. Harris is still tied to Biden, who is perceived as not doing well on the economy nor on immigration. Those things all play still favorably to Trump, who can say and do what he wants in the last few days of the campaign, and it's not going to cause him any huge problem. He's also tapped into some minority communities where he will get votes that he wouldn't have got previously, potentially to offset the female vote, which, and maybe this is the most interesting thing that Alex said, which should cause me some pause when I say Trump's still more likely, although marginally more likely, is that I think it was in Pennsylvania, there's 6% more female voters than male, and that's a huge tick for Kamala Harris. But I'm sure Ozan has some interesting views on this too.
Before I do that, I just wanted to just touch on, you know, I think it's unfair, or it's an unfair position that we put Alex in, but he did a brilliant job of really dissecting the data, both private, public, and he did, I think, you know, and he himself pointed out, as you, Adam and Rodney, have pointed out, that this is really actually too tight to call, and anything we do from here is just prediction based on a whole bunch of theories that that many people have, both on the Republican and Democratic side. So saying that, I'm going to make the case for why I think that the momentum is turning back around for Kamala Harris, and why I think she's going to win Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and I'm going to go out on a limb and say that she's also going to hold on to Nevada. So this is my thinking. Basically, I want to make 5 points, and I'll be very try to be very concise with them. I think first and foremost, I think that it's right now, you know, about getting the voters out, and I think the ground game with the, from what I've all of the things that I've read, spoken to a few people on the ground game is much stronger on the Democratic side. It has always been that way, mainly because of, I think, the unions and many of the progressive allies that come out for the Democrats during these occasions. They are able to put together a much more effective and, you know, from a quality point of view, but also a quantity point of view, a volunteer base that is actually, you know, very, very committed to kind of getting those voters out and canvassing across the country. Conversely, or on the other side, we know Trump has outsourced this function of his campaign to an organization called Turning Point. I believe Elon Musk is financing a lot of this. And there have been a whole bunch of anecdotal stories that have come out around many of these people who are not committed to the cause all that much, but, you know, going on knocking on people's doors where, you know, where in their yard they've got Kamala Harris and Waltz posters and really not knowing what they're doing. My second point is, I think Donald Trump had a great October, and I think he has done some brilliant things in that month. But I think the turning point came after the Joe Rogan interview. Joe Rogan obviously is one of the most listened to podcast hosts in the world. I think it might be one of the most listened to shows in the world, of course, after ours. But, you know, his jokes aside, I think he's probably got a bigger audience than anybody else in the world. And they had a nice kind of bros get together, have a conversation. You know, Trump, they unfortunately, I listened to all of it, and that says a lot about my sad life, mainly on fast forward at two or three speed at most of the time. But it was very clear that Joe Rogan's audience heard what they wanted to hear. Trump was quite good on there. He lied through his teeth on a lot of things, as he usually does. And Joe Rogan, on some occasions, pointed out a few things, but he came back and you know, really gave Donald Trump a pretty easy run, if you ask me. So that was very effective. However, I think what's happened since, and you know, you don't want to make a big issue out of what happened at Madison Square Gardens, but it's symbolic of something that I think has been happening over the last week or two in the Trump campaign, and that has been that. Both him and his supporters have got this idea in their mind that they've won. I think there's a bit of complacency that's set in, and they're doing things that, you know, that rally, and I don't think there's any point in calling it a Nazi rally, this and that, this stuff I think makes no difference. But what that rally showed is a very different contrast to, for example, what Kamala Harris's rally was on Tuesday with her closing statement, that, you know, these people are not serious people. And I think those people who, that part of the electorate that's still yet to make up their mind, are, I think, in my opinion, are going to be put off by a lot of the things that were covered in there. Of course, his base won't be. Donald Trump is a master at turning out his voters. He's also a master at turning out the opposition voters and Democrat voters as well. So, you know, people who needed to kind of hear something there that might sway them towards Trump, those independent voters, whoever's left, whether it's 2 or 3% that haven't made up their mind, I don't think heard anything at that rally. And since then, you know, Donald Trump yesterday jumping on a garbage truck, et cetera, talking and doing a whole bunch of doubling down on all of those things. I don't think that gave a lot of people reason to say, okay, I've decided, I've made up my mind, I'm going to go with Donald Trump. And not to mention, obviously, I think it will have some impact, and it only has to have a very small impact in a place like Pennsylvania. There are two counties where hundreds of thousands of Puerto Ricans live. And if you're looking at such a tight margin in Pennsylvania, which is what the data is saying, which is what Alex touched on as well, this could make a massive difference. So I think his closing is terrible. I think Kamala Harris is closing her campaign in a very clinical way. And, you know, I think she's showing a direct contrast between her and Trump. And I think that is a positive thing. And you're seeing it a little bit in the polls as well. I mean, today's CNN poll was probably the best poll that she's had in the last 2 or 3 weeks, showing a not a surge, but a turnaround of support for her in some of those battleground states. So that's, I think, that's my second point. My third point is, we don't know what the electorate's going to look like. We don't know who's actually going to vote. And there have been some demographic changes across since 2022 in some of those key states. And a gentleman by the name of William Frey, who's a world-renowned demographer, has presented that there's been a decline of about 2% in the white, non-college-educated voting base across the board, and specifically in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania as well. And obviously that's bad news for Trump, given that that's quite a solid part of his base. Secondly, there's been other people added onto the electorate, which are, you know, there are 1% more, college-educated whites, and then 1% more voters of color. And also another interesting thing is that, you know, in the last election, 1 out of 10 voters were young voters, so Gen Z or whatever you want to call them. To this year, it looks like it'll be 1 out of 6. So all of these things, I think, are very difficult to see, to really determine which way it's going to go. So that's why I believe that if some of these things may not be showing in the polls, and I think that, you know, particularly on the young stuff, and the younger demographic, I think we might see some surprises. Fourthly, I think I'm a bit concerned when, not concerned actually, I'll rephrase that. I'm a bit surprised when people still complain or talk about Harris not making her, agenda clear to people. I think, you know, Trump was leading 2 months ago on the question of the economy by about 14, 15 points, depending on which poll you look like. Today he's leading by about 5, but most importantly, in all of the swing states, it's, either she's leading or he's leading within the margin of error. So what that says to me is that Harris has been able to, over the last 2 months, make a very strong case for what she would do on the economy, but also what she would do on other issues as well. Whilst Trump's supporters were calling Puerto Rico garbage, a few hours before that, she released a Puerto Rico economic development plan, which didn't get much coverage. But that's the whole point. The media is not interested in anything serious. They complain that there's no serious policy, and when a party does put it forward, they're not interested in covering it because it's not very sexy. But she has released a hell of a lot of policies, and they are policies which, you know, most economists are saying are solid policies, as opposed to, for example, Donald Trump's policies of a 10% tariff. This is clearly a bad economic policy, but, you know, for some reason, there doesn't seem to be the same kind of scrutiny on Kamala Harris. And I get it, because I think Rodney very clearly pointed out that she's considered as an incumbent. And I think that really is going to be something that is going to, you know, and what Alex said is true. If she loses, it's less, I think, to do with people, still wondering what she's going to do for the economy. I think it's more around people associate her with Biden. And in the minds of people, Biden's done a terrible job on the economy. So that's going to taint her chances. But I don't think it's got anything to do with the fact that she doesn't have answers. She does. They're just not being covered. But a lot of those numbers that I've just quoted show you that the people who need to hear those policies have heard them and they've changed their mind about who they trust. So that's my fourth. My fifth reason is none of us know whether Trump is going to turn out everyone that he needs to turn out. He surprised us all in 2016. He surprised us all in 2020. But that doesn't necessarily mean that his turnout is going to be as high as those 2 years. So I think, you know, we're always surprised by Trump, but that doesn't mean that that trend needs to continue. And in fact, if you have a look, the people who have been surprising the political pundits in the last 2 or 3 years, certainly since the Dobbs election, have been the Democrats, who have consistently overperformed on the polls. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, you know, there's no reason for why with some of those things that I described, but most importantly, you know, the number of Republicans who voted for Nikki Haley, for example, you know, may really come out in force and be telling one thing to pollsters and doing another thing in the polling booth. And that might cause a significant surprise. So I know I said I was going to be concise, but these are my reasons for why I think we're going to be surprised, despite what the polling or the betting markets are saying, despite what, you know, many people are saying. I think Kamala Harris is going to surprise us.
Thank you for that incredibly detailed and really well thought out argument. Ozan, I think, as we keep saying, right, it's too close. And to me, you know, when you think about what is also likely to play out in the aftermath of the polling, I mean, Trump's both got a record and has sort of made it clear that he's going to be very big on looking at, you know, potential voter fraud and all that kind of stuff. It's likely that this, you know, we won't have a result on the night, almost certainly we won't have a result on the night, and that it will continue into the days and potentially weeks in the aftermath. You know, it's so easy to sit on the fence, but I think if I had to make a call, I would say that Trump will win. And I'm saying that based on, and I mean, you gentlemen know I've had this view from you know, for the past sort of 3 or 4 weeks, thinking that, yeah, I think Trump will win. And let me phrase it in this way. The aha moment for me in that conversation with Alex earlier in this podcast was when he said, I'm not surprised by anything Donald Trump does, and no one is surprised by anything that Donald Trump does. So if we take a step back and think all the way back to 2014, right, when he was first sort of on the scene running for president, to think that a presidential candidate and then a president can say the outrageous things that Donald Trump says, can do the outrageous things that Donald Trump does, can behave in that way, can be, you know, misogynistic, can be racist, can be loose with the truth and still run the United States for 4 years, do what he did on January 6th in 2020, then come back for another candidacy in 2024 and be where he is in the polls today, to me suggests that he is a force, an incredible force in US politics that, quite frankly, I don't even think a lot of people, sociologists, pollsters, demographers, really understand what it is about him and his base, and more importantly, the swinging voters who will be persuaded by him above and beyond Kamala Harris that will see him potentially return to the White House early next year. And I think on the balance of probabilities, that will outweigh any potential last-minute surprises from a voting and data perspective on Harris. I think everything that you've both said is true. I think, you know, Harris has done a good job of trying to get her policy cut through to the media. I think it hasn't. And that is not a failure on the media or the society. That is a failure on the Harris campaign, that they did not estimate correctly what the media would be interested in and what people would be interested in enough to be able to get that traction. Whereas Trump, on the other hand, regardless of all the outrageous stuff that we see and all the things that have happened in this campaign and prior to the campaign kicking off, it is not affecting him. It is not hitting him in the polls, to which I think the Harris camp has sort of backed on or backed up, I guess, in terms of their, you know, their messaging and what they're trying to get out there. So based on all of that, to me, I would say a Trump victory. It is, of course, going to be narrow regardless of what happens. And it's going to come down to tens of thousands of votes in those swing states that Alex took us through. But that's sort of my thinking on where things will land. Rodney, what did you have to say in regards to sort of the four and then the 5-point plan that Ozan laid out?
I mean, the other point which we sort of bear in mind at all times is he's doing better in the states that he needs to hold than she is in the ones that she needs to hold. He's doing better in the Sun Belt on polling and just needs to flip Pennsylvania. I know that Michigan and Wisconsin from the CNN poll today are leaning further towards Harris, but Pennsylvania is still tied. It's going to come down to incredibly small numbers. I also accept Ozan's point that there'll be Republicans who will vote, who will not say they're going to vote Harris, but potentially do that. But there's an awful lot of people who don't want to say they're voting Trump, who maybe aren't some of the people that we see doing vox pops at his rallies, but they've got a sneaking regard for some of the more offensive side of what he says and what his campaign does. And they'll also be a constituency within a constituency of people who are prepared to vote for him. The coverage of the what she stands for hasn't cut through. I take your point on the media, but she failed to campaign on her record. And I know that the garbage stuff from Biden might allow her finally to distance herself from him in some way, but that's a big problem as an incumbent. You've got to campaign on your record, and she's not been able to really stand over very much of it, despite the economic figures, because the view is that people weren't feeling it. But at no stage during the campaign has anything been said to make people start feeling it. And that's a gap, as well as the immigration stuff. Well, we accept we didn't really do anything because they stopped us. That's the response on that. Again, it's not great because they only stopped us after year three or whatever it happened to be, when we hadn't really made much progress prior to that. So I feel that she's had to move on to his territory a little bit. She's failed to campaign on her record. And those are all pretty big weaknesses. Anyone voting for Harris is voting against Trump, largely. And that's where this has arrived at. And she hasn't pulled people towards her in the way that she needed to make this a much more certain outcome. Now, she still may win. But as you said, Erdem, her winning is the start of another process, because we might have a result, but we'll not have an agreed result, and it will be litigated. And it just like she has to be lucky by in the Rust Belt, where the margins are very small, through all this litigation process that will take place inevitably afterwards, should she win, she's going to have to be lucky in that every time. As soon as they find one evidenced case of error or mistake or, heaven forbid, fraud, it's going to allow that to be apportioned to every other area where they place a question mark on a result. So I think this has a lot of distance to go should Harris sneak it, which is, again, I mean, it may well be that we finish the US election and are still talking about the US election for some weeks to come. But yeah, I'm all interesting points, but I think it's still marginally in Trump's favor.
I think if, you know, your point about the kind of silent or the hidden Trump supporters is a good one, but we've now had 8 years and the polling community or the polling profession has had 8 years to overcompensate for that. And, you know, we've seen, and further to the 2020 election, they continue to overcompensate for it in their weighting of results, et cetera. So I think it could very well still be there. You know, he might surprise us in terms of how many votes he does pull out. But my sense is the polling is very accurate this year, and that is that it's really tight. And I guess why I made the case for Kamala Harris is, on balance, when you're looking at such a tight kind of campaign and where literally every vote will count, I think that the issues that she's running on, I think, like, we're underestimating. I on the issues of her not being able to defend her record, you know, that was a really tough thing for her to do, and I agree, yeah, that's a major weakness. You know, on immigration, partly agree, but also I think it's damaged. I mean, when they did some polling just after the whole Trump, you know, is looking out for his own success in the elections, you know, he's looking out for himself, etc. That stuff polled very, very strongly, and I think we may be underestimating that. You know, it's kind of that stuff. It really showed the true side of Trump, which is that, you know, and which is what a lot of people are thinking, is that he's only running to keep himself out of jail. So all of these things on balance, I think it's a very close race, and on, you know, I just think it's going to tip over her way, and by the slimmest of margins. And I think that, you know, and completely agree with Adam and Alex's comment that no one should be surprised by what Trump says or does or anything like that. But that isn't the point. I mean, when you've got 2 or 3% of the population or the voting electorate who are trying to make up their minds, maybe it's more, we don't know, who are trying to make up their minds, they're not, surprise is not what we're looking for. It's who's the better candidate. And he hasn't done much in the last week or two to make himself look like the better candidate. And that is something that I think we're forgetting, that he has as much work as she does to do, because it's so close. Like, I think on the last podcast, I said that, you know, the sentiment, the economic sentiment, the wrong direction numbers, et cetera, are so bad. And there's so much anger against the incumbent kind of party that any other candidate should have run away with this. They should be 10 or 15 points ahead of Kamala Harris, but he's not. And he's not for a reason, because he's deeply unpopular. And the reality is, he's deeply unpopular in places and in segments and demographics where it's really problematic for him. And I think
that cuts both ways, Ozan, right?
Yeah, it does.
He should have run away with it because of the economic bit. She should have run away with it because he's absolutely bonkers.
Yeah.
And deeply offensive. Do you know what I mean?
And what we're seeing is exactly what we would expect to see, which is he has major negatives, she has major negatives, so it's a completely dead heat election. You know, so they've cancelled each other out from that point of view. I mean, she's a flawed candidate in some ways as well. There's no doubt about that. But again, it's just on balance in those small little margins. I think, you know, it's a worry when you're a week out of an election and you're trying to convince the American public that you didn't hold a Nazi rally. Now, whether it's a Nazi rally or not is not an issue. It gets you away from what you should be talking about, which is, I'm the better candidate, in Trump's case, for the economy. I'm going to fix this. You know, his message around I'm going to fix things is very good. It's very simple. It's very impactful. But what's he doing now? He's driving around with, you know, a bunch of dudes in a rubbish truck. Like,
air away from her again, though.
No, but it is. But it's showing he's not serious. It's showing he's not serious. And the people who are yet to make up their minds value that stuff. So they're not surprised by his behavior, but they value this stuff. And instead of going, okay, you know, things have been taken the wrong way, he's doubling down on it and driving around in rubbish trucks. So this is not something that you should be doing.
It's
off message.
This is where I think it's really interesting, because it's Trump the candidate, right? You're spot on. Of course, you know, it shows that you're not taking it seriously. It shows that, you know, you're a bit of a loony. Let's call a spade here. But the question is, for those undecided voters, let's put it frank. Everyone in the US who is going to come out and vote has an opinion on Donald Trump already, right? There is very little people in the polls say this who don't have an opinion about Donald Trump, right? No one will say, oh, yeah, I haven't really thought about him. No. Everyone's thought about him. Everyone has an opinion. The question is this behavior enough to persuade those who are sitting on the fence in those swing seats to come out and vote for Harris? And I don't think that it is, because they've already got the opinion.
It might be enough to get them to sit on the couch. It might be enough to get them to sit on the couch,
point.
Which is
that's
also
a really good point. Yeah,
which is also bad for him. But you're absolutely right, Adam. Like you've hit the nail on the head. Is it enough? We don't know. We have no idea. But even if they say screw this, I'm not going to go and vote, that's a problem for him, because he's relying on his margins are so slim. He's relying on a lot of those independents breaking his way, like they have done in the past.
Do you know what? We should actually move this on to what we think is going to happen. And by the way, there's one thing that I don't know that you're familiar with Jordan Klepper, who goes to a lot of these Trump rallies. He was back at one, I think, last week, and come up with a conspiracy theory to absolutely hose the one about the Democrats controlling the weather, which is that Trump's a time traveler and told himself to move slightly out of the way of the bullet. And therefore, they knew that he was already going to win. I mean, what an explanation that was! That was by far the most amazing thing that I've heard. Given that, you know, maybe telling him to stand somewhere else rather than move his head slightly at a precise second might have been better advice from a time traveler. But anyway, I think we should move it on to what do we think they deserve, having campaigned the way that they do? Or what do we think we would like the outcome to be? Because given where the campaigns are at and Harris's failure and Trump's lunacy, I would like to see them both punished for their poor campaigns. And I think there was a piece about a week or so ago when they thought they could tie the Electoral College. And in that situation, the House and the Senate would elect one each or something. And my ideal outcome now from this election is for Trump to have to serve as Harris's vice president and Harris to have to serve in an administration where she manages Trump. And I think that would both make them campaign differently, or at least get some satisfaction from their failures throughout this campaign.
And where is RFK in all of this?
He's
still the health secretary.
I don't think
in charge of the immunization program.
Immunization. I would have global immunization. I think we would have him responsible for, send him off to the World Health Organization for some immunization program. Make him do that. Again, when I talked about the list of crazies at that Madison Square Garden rally, I left him off because Tucker Carlson was so off the charts, as was Rudy Giuliani, that I didn't even deal with RFK. Anyway, so in the event of a tie, there is this theoretical possibility that they would have to work together. Maybe that's the outcome that we should all hope for.
That's the title of the show, Adam.
Well, the outcome that we should hope for. Could Kamala Harris be president and Donald Trump be vice president? One of our hosts thinks so.
Yeah, because it wouldn't work the other way around, would it? It has to be this way around for them both to suffer in equal measure.
How do we punish the two presidential candidates? Put simply, has its own ideas. Well, you know what? Given how absolutely crazy this campaign in this year has been, and the greatest political theater that we've ever seen, I think, starting obviously with really the assassination attempt and then the Biden withdrawal, etc., I would not be surprised if there's another twist in the tale here. Just in the interests of putting things simply, the key states to watch next Tuesday, for those of you who will be glued to the screens, which I think at least the three of us will be, as sad as we are, as the states within the Rust Belt is Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, absolutely key. One of the ones that is really too close to call. And then if we head over to the west in the Sun Belt, we have Nevada, which is traditionally voted Democrat, but is up really for grabs at the moment. And Arizona, back over to the southeast, it's North Carolina and Georgia. Those seven states are the ones to keep your eyes on, and the ones that obviously all the major networks will be trying very, very hard to predict, which will allow to, I guess, make the call on the projection as to who will win if indeed we have a result on Tuesday night, which, given the closeness of the race and the polling, is very unlikely. But speaking of Georgia, let's head right out east now, outside of the US, to another Georgia. And there's been some interesting developments in what's happening in that country. Rodney, take us through what's going on.
So they've had their election last weekend. Georgia Dream, which is, I'm going to say, pro-Russian party. This is the you know, the furtherance of the Moldovan thing from a couple of weeks ago as well. Georgia Dream, pro-Russian, won the election by 54%. Lots of allegations of voter fraud. The president herself has said that it was a stolen election, in effect, and refused to accept the outcome. The parliament has appointed the prosecutor's office to investigate. The president is now saying that she's not going to cooperate with the prosecutor's office because it was appointed by the government, who were the beneficiaries of the fraudulent election result. And the other great parallel with Moldova, of course, sitting behind Georgian Dream, is Bidzina Ivanishvili, who is a Georgian billionaire, made his money in the breakup of the Soviet Union, very pro-Russia, and he's the man behind Georgia Dream. He served as a prime minister in 2012, maybe 2013, and has sort of had chairmanship of the party and senior roles within the party rather than frontline politics since then. So, yeah, Georgia's in absolute turmoil. Again, Russia interference on a pretty significant scale. And the president now has to go for election, I think, 45 days after the parliamentary election. It's a college-type system. And that's the next phase of it. So in the interim, there's going to be disputes around the outcome of the election. And if there was one piece of evidence we needed to know that it was potentially or likely voter fraud, the man who's been dispatched to rubber stamp the outcome is Viktor Orban from Hungary, who's gone to congratulate Georgia Dream in Georgia on the successful outcome of the election. You know, I mean, that's pretty bad, really, as a point of evidence for a valid and true outcome for the election. So yeah, Georgia's in a lot of difficulties. Moldova had similar pressures in their election, and yet in the West, we think that it's unlikely Russia would interfere in our elections. But if they're able to do it near at home, there's high likelihood that there has been Russian influence at play, certainly online, in other elections. And I'm sure there'll be some discussions post the American election of what may or may not have been external influence in that particular election. So, yes, Georgia, a lot of problems. It's not going to resolve itself very easily. It's a great shame because in 2022, Georgia was a European accession nation candidate. Then they passed a foreign influence law, similar to cracking down on dissidents within Russia and so on. And that put them outside that process for that very reason. So there were protests earlier in the week, and we expect to see a degree of unrest as that election is argued over. But as you both know, when there has been an outcome and you're trying to argue against that outcome, it becomes a very muddy or murky process.
All I know is I think Trump's going to win Georgia. Sorry, are we off the US election top? Sorry,
he sort of did, or he sort of did.
Mate, that was my 5 cents worth to this topic that I don't know much about.
Populism has already won in Georgia. That should be the headline. But yeah, for the Georgian people, this is bad news. It may stop them from being on the wrong end of Russian. Further Russian encroachment into their territory, which of course happened previously, but Long term, you know, it's not good for Georgian democracy.
Well, Jones, next time we meet, we will have some indication of a result in the US election, something that obviously we've been covering for most of this year here on Put Simply. In fact, it was our very first episode all the way back in January, just shortly after the Iowa caucuses. Rodney, I'll start with you. Tell me what you're doing on election night. How will you be watching it?
I haven't decided whether I want to sit with other electoral dirds, and yes, they do exist. And sort of go blue by blue, but I'm likely to have television, radio, and internet all probably running at the same time, with a pencil and some paper, making notes on things that I find interesting to probably refer back to later. But yeah, I'll be sitting alone to watch this, and then. Maybe I'll try and phone people in different time zones to have mini discussions at various points. But yeah, that might be one option. But yeah, it's going to be, yeah. I mean, this is hugely interesting and hugely important globally, as well as for the future of America. It's important for the future of NATO, the West, democracy, vis-a-vis autocracies, and those who are going into this autocratic space. This is a hugely important election. And it's exciting and nerve-wracking in equal measure.
Mate, I thought you were old school when you said you'd have the radio on and then you took out the pencil and paper, and I thought, oh, Jesus Lord, that's real old school there.
It is. I even have a whiteboard that I write on as well.
it's nerd central at your house, that's for sure. Ozan, you'll be in the US. What's the plans for election night?
Well, I hope to be in a diner in somewhere in Pennsylvania, watching it with those wonderful people in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, that's the plan at this point in time. I don't know. We're going on a bit of a tour of Pennsylvania starting this weekend, and depending on where we are, we'll be in, I assume, diner in the middle of nowhere, or perhaps back in Philadelphia by then, crashing either a Trump event or a Kamala event, or even both, just to mix things up a little bit. So let's see.
Your bubble's going to be so burst if you end up in some Puerto Rican diner and they're supporting Trump despite what's been said. You'll be flying back the same afternoon.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, safe travels to you, and happy election day, gents. Next time we meet, we can go through, I guess, what's happened and what's transpired. So wonderful speaking to you both again this week. See you next.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And that's been this week's episode of Put Simply. Be sure to follow us on LinkedIn at Oroku Group to stay up to date with all the latest episodes and news. Feel free to leave a comment and suggestions on what you'd like to see featured on the podcast as well. Until next time, I'm Erdem Koch.
And I'm Ozan Ibrahim.
Thanks for listening.